Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome, and a very warm welcome to Trevor Manuel, the Finance Minister of South Africa, who, despite the many, many things that are going on in Washington right now, agreed to come and share his views on the report he chaired, the group he chaired on IMF reform. We have a fantastic group. I'm so grateful to everyone, to George Soros, to my friend Jose Antonio Ocampo, and to Eswar Prasad. Let me just briefly introduce the panel. Actually, they really don't need any introduction, but nonetheless, Trevor Manuel has been finance minister in South Africa for over a decade. He has steered South Africa from very, very difficult times to much better times, although huge challenges remain, of course. And he did come from the struggle for freedom and equality himself. So he combines the attributes of a strong finance minister, quite hard sometimes, as finance ministers have to be, with social conscience, with generosity. My teacher many years ago was Alan Blinder at Princeton, and he has this good formula, which I like, saying one has to have a soft heart and a hard hat, and Trevor definitely has it. He has been chairing, among many other things, this committee to look into the reform of IMF governance. And as he will share with us, the focus really was on governance, not on all the policy issues and all the other things that one can discuss about the IMF. And he will share his views with us. The report has not yet been formally discussed by the board, I understand, but has been released, is on the IMF website, and has elicited a huge amount of interest. And I do believe that at this point, when the IMF is heading towards being a much larger institution financially, a crucial institution, perhaps an institution that will go up to $1 trillion in terms of war chest, how such an institution is governed has become all the more crucial and all the more important, and is at the heart, I think, of what's going to happen during these spring meetings and also the meetings in Istanbul later. We have George Soros, who, of course, is another soft heart and hard head. I think few people in the world know markets better, have participated successfully, as you know, have anticipated events that few others anticipated. But what makes the big difference, two big differences really, is that George has devoted his energies to development, to governance, to democracy, to bettering humankind, and has in many ways, I was in the business at the UN of measuring aid budgets, and his aid budget is larger than many, many countries put together. And he has also written many books on the nature of markets and of society, really. And it's really a combination of philosophy, mathematics, and economics. And I'm sure many of you have read much of what he's written. And so we're lucky to have George Soros to join the discussion and also comment specifically on what Minister Manuel will have to say. Then we have Jose Antonio Ocampo, professor at Columbia University right now. Before that, my colleague at the United Nations as head of the Economic and Social Affairs part of the United Nations, undersecretary. Before that, head of the Economic Commission for Latin America. And before that, minister of both on the economic side and on agriculture, I think also, in his native Colombia. He has just finished, or not maybe not quite finished, but written at least and sent to his friends an excellent paper on the role of SDRs, reserve currency arrangements, in this new period we're facing after this financial crisis. And finally, we have Eswar Prasad, my new colleague at Brookings, who is the new century chair, a senior fellow here at Brookings, who is also the senior professor of trade policy at Cornell University, who at the IMF was head of the financial studies division, but also division chief for China. And I'm sure many of you have read his multiple articles, and both in learned journals, but also in the press. So with that, I will turn to Trevor Manuel to share his perspective with us and to start the discussion this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Kemal. Good afternoon to all of you, and thanks for your time here. When Dominic called me just under a year ago and asked me to chair this. He gave us a mandate until the spring meetings this year. And we put a team together that probably is as representative as you could have. Governor Zhou, Governor of the People's Bank of China, Sri Mulyani Indrawati, Finance Minister of Indonesia, Guillermo Ortiz, the Central Bank Governor in Mexico, Amartya Sen, Mohammed El Erian, and then Ken Dam, formerly of Brookings Institute, and Bob Rubin. This was the team given about 10 months to try and put a report together. And the issues at play are those that emerge very strongly from the independent evaluations report that was released last year, that perhaps for the first time from that perspective took a long, hard look at the operations of the bank, of the fund, what Dominic asked us to do was to try and make some sense of this and arrive at some recommendations. So against that backdrop, let me just share a few observations. Firstly, John Kenneth Galbraith once observed that the outcomes of all financial crises are similar, if not the same. Institutions and governments move to regulate and reform, pointing fingers at someone to blame, and amid the rush, fail to address the underlying problem. There are many factors that contribute to the present crisis, but as Ben Bernanke recently said at the Council on Foreign Relations, it's impossible to understand this crisis without reference to the global imbalances in trade and capital flows that began in the latter half of the 90s. The committee tried to look at these issues, and I think when we started, the crisis was not in as much focus as it is now, but clearly informed the way in which we developed the ideas as we proceeded. And we recognize that part of the difficulty, and it's spoken of in whispered tones, is that you don't actually have an institution at the center that's strong enough with views that are sufficiently resonant and respected. And part of what you must deal with is a reconstruction of an institution that's actually respected and listened to. Whatever else you do, that must be an objective, because in the absence of a strong institutions overseeing, advising, and doing tested peer reviews, you have something akin to anarchy. So issues of rules of the game, who defines them, how you define them, hello Nancy, are very important. And we recognize that the fund has clearly not been that center for a very long period of time. The world has changed. The resources of the fund no longer match potential needs. And if you look at the size of capital flows through the latter half of the 90s against the war chest that the IMF has, then you begin to understand a part of the reason why it has not been listened to. So it's also important to recognize that in the 65 years of its existence, the distribution of economic activity around the world has changed in very important and permanent ways. Core mandate of the fund, surveillance and conditionality, then became one-sided, while commitments to common standards and assessments weakened. And in many respects, the governance framework of the fund came to reflect these contradictions and inconsistencies rather than address them and ensure that the fund was equipped to prevent and resolve future crises. When the team was put together, it was asked a few questions: whether the institutional framework of the fund through which members' voting power is actually exercised also requires reform, taking into account the significant changes that have taken place since the fund's establishment, and secondly, to assess the adequacy of the fund's existing institutional framework and advise as to what, if any, modifications of this framework may be necessary to enable the fund to fulfill its mandate more effectively. This was then our remit, and we sought to develop a set of proposals against this backdrop. Now, one of the issues, and it had to enter the discussion at various points, quota and voice reform. A very important issue, but outside of our mandate. And a part of the battle we've had is how much we try and get at before running ourselves into so much difficulty because we just generate so much resistance from a very wide spectrum. And so we've tried to confine ourselves in some ways. And these are the recommendations. The first is the activation of what was agreed to at Bretton Woods, namely a ministerial council. Keynes has written on this and articulated this very smartly. If one can draw on something that Mervyn King said, he said, only if countries are willing to share confidences with each other, discuss their policy reaction functions, will international meetings justify the cost. And part of what we want is to ensure that the costs are justifiable. So we're looking for a council that may draw on some of the tenets of the IMFC as presently structured, but there needs to be a series of changes. I can say without fear of contradiction that the idea of a council is not one that is willingly received in the executive boardroom of the IMF. It's funny, Alex, it's true. But like the board, the idea is that the council will be constituency-based. So it remains representative, but there's a very strong emphasis on reducing the size. There'd have to be some negotiation about the composition. But the key emphasis has to be on function. And we're looking towards a council that has a kind of strategic oversight, looking at issues like systemic stability, early warning, fund lending facilities, and the selection of the managing director. Now, we haven't been able to resolve this work, and this to readers will clearly present itself as a contradiction. We haven't quite dispensed with the board. So how they coexist in the short term is something that needs to be considered. But at the moment, you have a rather strange situation where the governors are policymakers, ministers, and central bank governors all. The executive directors are, in the main, public servants. But ministers exist to advise public servants, and clearly that is what must be inverted to bring governance to bear. So in terms of trying to shift the function of the board, the short-term issues would relate to some budgetary issues, some reviews of policy effectiveness, affecting the performance of management without in any way trying to micromanage. And this clearly is there in the IEO report. The board meeting thrice a week finds it almost impossible to do anything but try and micromanage the institution. And so those lines of blood that would arise in corporate governance reports everywhere. And, you know, we go back to Keynes, who argued that the function of the EDs was not to manage the fund, but to act as a link between the managing director and national treasuries and central banks. And we thought this appropriate, which is why we make this recommendation as strongly as we do. Then we have made a reference to the need to rebalance quota shares and adjustments to the size and composition of the board in order to strengthen representation at the fund. There was an earlier process set in motion in October of 2007. We are of the view that without venturing into that terrain, it's much too gradual a process. Because it calls for a 2013 conclusion. That is much too long unless you deal with all of these reforms as a package, I think we're going to tend to want to talk past each other. Now, one of the issues that has to arise in the context is that the size and composition of the board must be adjusted, and almost inevitably, two things arise. The one is the reservation for five chairs for the largest quota holders will have to be looked at, and all chairs must be elected on an equal basis. And secondly, the impolite elephant in the room, Europe, and the need for consolidation of the number of European chairs. Then, some review of the decision-making rules of the fund. Two approaches to consider. The first of those is lowering the voting threshold on critical decisions from 85 to 70 or maybe even 75%. And secondly, to extend the number of double majorities, those issues over which you need both shareholding and country representatives to ensure that there's a better sense of equity within the institution. And fifthly, then the introduction of changes to the recruitment and the mandate of management and staff. And finally, to bring back into play issues relating to the legal mandate to ensure that the fund is able to evolve its role, taking account of a number of issues at play. At the annual meetings in 1997 in Hong Kong, there was a decision recorded well in the communique of what was then the interim committee, ad hoc committee. What was the IMFC's predecessor called? Interim committee. Asking the fund to look at issues relating to current account convertibility and more financial issues. It was clearly a good idea at the time, debated for a very long period, but never implemented. Now, if we deal with those issues, I think the way in which the fund will work with a newly established financial stability board is something that would need to be considered as well, because I think the emphasis that we're trying to place on this is to reconstruct a multilateral center. Ultimately, the fund's ability to act in global interest will depend on its governance structure that is fairly adaptable, that reflects the weight of emerging market countries in the global economy, and that gives all of the fund's clients, especially low-income countries, a meaningful role in decision-making. In conclusion, the argument for this to be dealt with as a package is fundamentally important because there are so many different interests at play. But dealing with it as a package, I think, will also assist individual members in the global economy or global community to take these decisions, and they're tough decisions, but to take them together. Thank you.
Well, I think this is a very important report, and if it gets through, it will be a great improvement. So I wholeheartedly support it. And I'd just make maybe a couple of suggestions that would have been even better, because the big problem in the fund is that it's got a resident board and with a big staff, which takes up a lot of time of the staff, and they do micromanage and interfere. And of course, the voting power is out of date, so it's really kind of skews the functioning of the fund to a very large extent. And the report goes quite some ways to reduce the functions, trying to take some functions away. But as long as you have a resident board, it's very difficult to stop them from micromanaging. And it would be better not to have a resident board. It's a very unusual thing to have. It actually absorbs 10% of the IMF's budget. So I don't think you pushed that far because you didn't think it was realistic to get it through. And probably that's correct. But I think one should at least say that that would be a much better system. And to have a council, that's fine. It's, I think it sort of strengthens the international, there is a council now, it's a finance council or something, that would be replaced by this, and it would be a stronger one. And then this is, these are the finance ministers who would have a deputy who follow international institutions. They should be at home and come once a month, maybe even if for to the meetings. And then they could have a deputy who's sitting there and reports to them, but they don't have the clout to interfere in the day-to-day management. That would be, I think, a better arrangement. And as far as the rearrangement of the voting, it's a slow process, and it ought to be really faster. And I think it's particularly the rise of China and I anticipate that that will actually accelerate in this crisis. And therefore, China needs to be drawn in to play a much more active role in multilateral arrangements, because otherwise they'll be all bilateral and will make the multilateral institutions, the international institutions, far less relevant. So the relevance of the financial, of the IMF and the international financial institutions very largely depends on how engaged China is. And at the moment, it hasn't yet happened. When China contributes $40 billion to NAB, the new arrangements to borrow, when Japan contributes $100 billion, it shows that they are ready to play, but they feel that they are not, they don't have sufficient weight. It's not something that you can solve with the report, but I just want to emphasize how important that is. Now, the terms of reference concern governance. Since the commission was appointed, we now have a financial crisis where, in fact, the global financial system has collapsed. And the IMF is facing a totally new task, namely to effectively provide protection for the periphery countries against the storm that generated at the center. And moreover, it's the commercial banking, the financial system that has collapsed. And the IMF is basically designed to deal with governments. And so dealing with the private sector is something which was, the IMF was not designed for. And therefore, I think the IMF has to be very much more substantially reorganized, the Articles of Association changed, in order to deal with this crisis properly. I could talk about this a lot more. If you have time, I'm happy to return to it. But I think we should stick to the subject.
Thank you very much, George. We'll have a second round. But I do want to again encourage both the panelists, but also the colleagues from the floor, to come back to this interaction between the huge challenge and responsibility that the IMF has been given now. You know, it has tripled, it is tripling in size, and maybe will go even more. The potential for SDR allocations, and I'm sure Jose Antonio Campo will touch on that, and the governance. The two things cannot really be separated. You cannot have such a crucial institution with a war chest of $1 trillion and have deficient governance. So the governance is absolutely essential to the whole issue. Jose Antonio, do you want to make your remarks from here, or you can? I think it's better to go. You want to do it from here?
No.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Kemal, for this invitation, and let me start by congratulating Trevor for I think, a very important and constructive report. Let me say just briefly what I really like about this report. The first is that it's truly multilateral in the spirit. So I think the spirit of this is that, for instance, that macroeconomic policy coordination should take place in the IMF, not in the G7, not in the G20, not in the G2. I think that's a very important point. It has a little sleep with the Financial Stability Forum, which I will come back to that. The second, I think the idea of a council of ministers is a great idea. I think it should be implemented. It's not easy. The executive board doesn't like it, but I think it's a great idea. I think the main policy issues of the IMF should be decided by councils of ministers. Third, the clear divisions of functions that it establishes is actually an excellent one. And it has many advantages in the recommendations for developing countries. First of all, the reduction of the threshold for critical decisions from 85% to 75%, which in fact eliminates the U.S. veto, which I think is a great advance. The recomposition of the members of the board, that of course is quite critical on the other recommendation that all chairs be elected. So these are a collection of recommendations that I think are excellent. And the quota review, I'll come back in the second round on the issues of the quota review. And of course, and not least, the open and transparent appointment of the managing director and the deputy managing director. I think those are, as a collection of recommendations on governance of the IMF, they are really great recommendations. I do have a couple of caveats I want to underscore on this issue. The first one is, having been a finance minister of a country that never sits on the board, I am extremely conscious of the 160 members who are not sitting on the board. And I think the report doesn't quite grasp the issue. I think the double majority, is one way of managing that, but it's not the only way of managing it. There has to be a special governance rule for the small. Forces a special consideration of issues that are not of the members sitting. Of course, if all are constituencies, you are supposed to speak through the head of your constituency. And I think the constituent system of the IMF and the World Bank is actually better. I actually recommend that, if there is any time a UN Economic and Social Council, it should be based on a constituency system. Even the Security Council, in my view, should be based on a constituency system. But anyway, it's not always true that the head of the constituency will take into account the views of the smaller members of the constituency, and I think that issue has to be addressed with specific. Not to say the abuses that small countries may be subject to in IMF processes. I think there should be a special channel by which they can redress their interests. I think that is a specific issue I want to underscore. And the other has to do with the extension of the IMF mandates that the report incorporates. In principle, I agree with the basic suggestion that it has to be responsibility for the overall stability of the international economy, which includes not only exchange rate, but macroeconomic policies, financial stability, and capital account regulations. I have no problem with the macroeconomic policies extending that mandate in that area. In prudential issues, I have the problem that the report recommends a link with the Financial Stability Forum, but the Financial Stability Forum is not a legitimate body. It's not a truly multilateral institution. So I think if we are going to build a world regulatory authority, it has to be a multilateral. So I prefer actually, the alternative proposal I have been is let the BIS become a universal body and give the that responsibility to the Bank of International Settlements. That is my, I think, the other view. Or give it to the IMF, but with full powers in the regulatory area, not as a link with the financial stability. And on capital account, the problem that I have is that I was Minister of Finance at the time of the 1997 meetings, and I totally distrusted what was going on. I think they were trying to impose capital account liberalization on developing countries. I mean, that was implicit, the objective of the reform. So the Bretton Woods system was established on the basis that countries were absolutely free to control capital in any way they wanted, actually even force controls under certain circumstances. So I think I don't mind actually giving some mandates to the IMF on capital account. I actually have recommended that actually the IMF should actually advise countries on what sort of capital control they should establish. I think it could make sense, and we could get back to this issue. But the way of phrasing this has to be very clear, so that countries maintain the autonomy to regulate the capital account. The only thing that should be demanded of the IMF is when those regulations may have a spillovers on other countries. We cannot give up capital account regulations, only we have a true lender of last resort, which we will not have in the foreseeable future. And for that particular reason, and for another reason, which is the fact that capital flows are extremely procyclical for developing countries, it makes sense for developing countries to continue using capital controls. So how you phrase it, so I don't mind giving a mandate to the IMF in that area, but I will think how to phrase it specifically so as to be clear that countries can use capital controls. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
I think you should have contributions from the floor before we have a second round.
This is a report that needs to be taken far more seriously than it has. Not necessarily because it has any proposal that is particularly innovative or particularly radical, but because it puts together a set of proposals that have been on the table for a while and fleshes them out in a particularly important context. And the context right now is critically important because we are at a time of sea change, not just in the world economy, but in terms of the institutions that govern the world economy. And clearly the IMF, as per the G20's wishes, is going to be playing a central role in the functioning of the global economy, both in terms of macroeconomic and financial stability and surveillance thereof. And therefore, we need a strong IMF. The report has a number of intriguing points, as Jose already mentioned. There is the notion of capital account surveillance coming back to the IMF, which of course raises the hackles of emerging markets, but it is very nuanced in the report. There are other issues like reducing the veto power of the IMF, essentially taking it away by reducing the threshold of voting for important issues to 70%, which again would improve the legitimacy of the IMF. But stepping back, I think there are two critical issues one will need to think about in terms of the frame of reference for this report. The first issue is, who is the fund going to be relevant for? Now, Mr. Soros has correctly pointed out that the fund has a role not just in terms of the advanced countries, but in terms of thinking about the periphery. But I have a different notion of the periphery. Countries that used to be thought of as being on the periphery, that is the non-advanced countries, the emerging markets, I think have now definitively moved into the core. It is the outer periphery, or what used to be the outer periphery, that is now moved into the periphery, that the IMF has clearly become much more important for. There are countries like Iceland, Latvia, Ukraine, where clearly the IMF is playing a very important supportive role at this time of crisis. These are not unimportant countries, but they are not systemically important. And in the context of global imbalances, they are not the systemically important surplus countries. And that, to me, is the critical issue. How does one think about making the IMF relevant for the systemically important surplus countries that had an important role to play in the formulation of global imbalances, which to a significant extent have got us where we are? And there is a fundamental tension that arises in the context of the IMF's role in terms of its macroeconomic surveillance function and in terms of the insurance function. My view is that ultimately we're going to have to set up an insurance system that is relevant not just for the periphery countries, but also for the systemically important surplus countries. Now, the IMF has responded very positively. The flexible credit line, which is essentially a way for countries that have gotten themselves pre-approved to have access to large amounts of finance, is an excellent innovation. And Colombia, Poland, and Mexico have signed on. And yet these are, again, not the systemically important surplus countries. There have been very important changes in international capital markets right now. The fund lacked resources, and now it seems to have them aplenty, although some of those resources are still commitments rather than actual money on the table. But even if that works out, the question is whether countries that view themselves as having been burnt by the IMF in the past, one thinks in particular about the countries of East Asia, are ever going to let themselves be in a position where they will have to come back to the IMF. Because in its role as an institution that is doing macroeconomic surveillance, the IMF cannot credibly commit to not having conditionality in the future. Mexico has qualified today. If it runs poor policies for the next year, the IMF should rightfully disqualify them. So if you have a country that is concerned about this prospect, the question is whether that country is going to sign up for the credit line and say, I will forswear my insurance function and give it up to the IMF. My answer is probably not. And in fact, we have seen that other things have changed as well. The leveraging effect of IMF capital has declined substantially. Now when the IMF gives a country its seal of good approval, private capital doesn't follow. So for both of those reasons, my view is that the surplus countries are likely to have, if anything, an incentive to insure themselves even further, even though the IMF is important. Another aspect which makes this insurance function difficult to see as residing with the IMF is related to legitimacy, which I think is a critical issue that this report touches on. Now, the quota reform is moving at a glacial pace. If you think about the changes that are contemplated for 2013, those are very, very modest. In fact, the way I see them is these are not substantive reforms. These are decimal place reforms. And at a time like this, we need to be moving beyond decimal place reforms into something much more substantive. It is a difficult, arduous process. I've been at the fund. I know that these negotiations can be extremely convoluted, especially because it is a zero-sum game. But this is a time when the institution needs to be altered fundamentally in terms of its legitimacy, especially with all the resources it's getting. And for quota reforms to proceed at this absolutely glacial pace, moving forward things from 2013 to 2011, and again, just decimal place changes, to me, just does not cut it. So I think it's essential to have that be right up front. And it's only when you get that sort of legitimacy that the emerging markets are also going to feel that they have a stake in the institution, and more importantly, that the fund is treating them with balance with the advanced countries. In his Financial Times op-ed yesterday, Timothy Geithner said that the IMF should have a proactive role in holding our feet to the fire of our good intentions. There's at least one mixed metaphor in there, although I can't quite pick it out. But Timothy Geithner was making a very important point that he feels that the IMF should play an important role in terms of surveillance of advanced countries as well. But the problem is not that the IMF has been very soft on the advanced countries. It's that the IMF says the right thing, but then the advanced countries ignore them. And there is a feeling among the emerging markets, and China is a prime example here, that they're getting beaten upon because they are less economically important. So I think this issue of legitimacy becomes very important, even in terms of the core macroeconomic surveillance function. So in terms of placing all of these issues on the table and bringing them up front, although again, like Mr. Soros, I wish the report had been even bolder in pushing for wider reforms and much quicker. But I think this report, nevertheless, is doing us a very good service and does need to be taken more seriously. Thanks.
Thank you. I think I would like to turn to the floor now, and particularly first to three people who are in the front row. But we need a microphone. Is there a microphone somewhere that's going to materialize, I hope? Anyway, okay, there it is. Okay. So we have three guests in the front row whom I'd like to turn to first. One is Caroline Atkinson, head of the External Relations Department of the Fund. Maybe, Carolyn, I'll let you be the last of the three, since you're, in a way you react and you tell us, okay? Nancy Birdsall, president of the Center for Global Development, who's been blogging very actively on all these issues. Maybe, Nancy, you can start. But then we have a special guest, Guy Ryder, who's the head of the International Trade Union Federation, not always kind of unfortunately present in these meetings. But I do believe that with the IMF thrust in this new role, playing this critical role in the world economy, it is high time that the labor movement, civil society largely, people who are not connected to the financial sector, gain a strong say in what's going to happen. So first Nancy, then Guy, and then Caroline. And then we'll turn it more openly, and then we'll go back to the panel.
Well, thank you, Kemal. I feel a bit honored. It shows that blogs matter, I suppose. I don't know if Trevor read mine. He might be a little annoyed if he did. On the report of the committee. I think this was really a great discussion and important issues raised. And I was thinking, as an American, it's a bad metaphor, but using baseball, because it's not as multilateral as it should be. But I would say this report sort of got us to second base. And we need a home run. And I'm thinking it might be useful for a group like this to encourage Trevor to ask for a second round, because things have caught up. You know, the committee finished its report before the G20 meeting that put almost $1 trillion into the IMF. And so some of it might have been more bold if it had known how fast things would change at the IMF in terms of resources. Let me make three quick points on how the report could be added to, so we get from second base to home plate. First, on the quota reform, I think Ezwar put it really very nicely. You know, so slow and decimal points. But I think we have to appreciate the effort of the committee to be effective and not to create sort of so much radioactivity in response to something more bold that there would be no progress at all. At the same time, I think it would make more sense now, as a follow-up, to say on what specific decisions, or some committee to recommend on what specific decisions there should be double majority voting. Because double majority voting, where you have countries as well as weighted votes counting, provides a mechanism for coalition building between emerging markets and low-income countries, between low-income countries with each other, and so on. And in particular, if it could be applied clearly to the decision for the next, who is the next head of the IMF, I think that would be, you know, a bold move. I was at the IDB for many years, the Inter-American Development Bank, where there's a double majority voting. You have to have half the countries in the region to elect the president, and it creates tremendous legitimacy, tremendous sense of ownership. But there are obviously other decisions. So that would be my approach, is instead of go along with the quota reform, but recognizing the decimal points don't really get you there in terms of legitimacy, except so slowly, and except for a few countries like China, perhaps India, that will eventually get to 5, 6, 7, or 10%. The second point I'd like to make is maybe it would be more effective on the board issue to call for the end of a full-time board instead of the end of a resident board, and to say countries could have their counselors in the embassies in Washington be the board member one day a week. And so there would still be a sort of a resident board. It might open up more space politically for progress there. It's just an idea that I thought might be worth floating. And the third thing is, I would like to see a follow-up, and I think Trevor and his group could be very powerful in this, in being much more clear in calling for a bargain between the U.S. and the Europeans, where the U.S. gives up its veto on certain key decisions, and I think the report could, in a second round, could clarify which decisions. I mean, obviously the problem is in the Congress, so there has to be a lot of discussion in thinking about how to put something on paper that is likely to be acceptable in the Congress. It's the Congress that's the problem. that's what the U.S. would cede, and the Europeans would cede a couple of chairs and some sort of a background political process that did that. Now, I don't want to go on too long, but I want to say something that Dominique Strauss-Kahn said. We had a conference yesterday sponsored by the Center for Global Development, where I'm from, and SAIS. And I asked a question of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and he had this interesting suggestion on the veto issue that I thought I should ask maybe for Trevor or others to respond to, which was, why don't we have, if we can't get rid of the veto altogether? First, he was very politically smart and said, you know, it's not just the U.S. that has a veto. The Europeans, if they get together, have a veto. The emerging markets have a veto. So there are different coalitions that have a veto. But if it's difficult to change from 85% of votes cast, maybe the next step would be 85% of all votes, of all weighted votes, to go to 85% of votes cast, so that if the U.S. didn't vote or abstained on awkward issues, there could still be progress.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Guy.
Thank you very much, Kamal. Thank you very much for the opportunity to contribute. Firstly, with reference to what the previous speaker just said, I'm a Brit and I don't understand baseball, but I've always thought it's actually a perfect analogy for multilateralism. It's only in baseball that the winner of the US competition proclaims itself winner of the World Series, and I think there's a really a very good metaphor about multilateralism involved in that. With others, I would welcome this report. I mean, I'm relatively new to its findings, and I suspect it does reflect sort of a middle way between a reflection of what is possible and what one would ideally like. I think one is always, in such circumstances, caught between the pragmatism of let's try and achieve what we can get, rather than the perfect being the enemy of the possible. But perhaps a few comments on its substance. The first is really to think, well, you know, is this going to happen? Speaking of the milieu that I come out of, the trade union movement, I'm always amazed by the capacity of structures to defend and prolong their own existence. They're masters at it. It's almost a law of organizational theory. So I'm wondering how quickly this is going to move, which leads to two thoughts. The first is, at this present moment, what is the major driver of change in the view of those who have been doing this work? Is it to improve the legitimacy of the IMF? Is it to improve the effectiveness of the IMF? Both elements are referred to in the literature that we've been given today and in connection with the committee. It seems to me, if in the absence of the adoption of any reform, it is reasonable to suppose that the authors of this report would regard the IMF as being operating at less than optimal effectiveness, at less than optimal legitimacy. The question that arises from that in my mind is it reasonable for the G20 or other decision makers who have recently decided on a major increase of resources and power for the IMF, to make the increase in resources in any way conditional upon the passage of reform? Is it reasonable for us as an international community to pump this much money and give this much influence to organizations which those who have great experience of it appear to believe is lacking, to some extent at least, in terms of legitimacy and effectiveness? The second is rather looking backwards rather than forwards. Presumably, we are undertaking this exercise with a view to the IMF behaving differently, to undertaking its work differently, and to producing results which are different from those of the past. The international trade union movement has been highly critical of much of the work of the IMF and its impact on working people. Could I ask anybody who cares to pick up the question, if these reforms had been adopted, let's say, a decade ago, would you expect us to be anywhere different from where we are today? would you have expected the IMF to have behaved in any way differently than it has over the last decade? And lastly, a question which I think is perhaps a naive one, but one which I still want to ask. As I've understood the proposals on voting and quota, the major intent is to update the circumstances that exist today. That is to say, to bring voting power better into line with the financial weight of different economies. Is that not open to the criticism that this is simply locking the IMF into existing inequalities in the global economy when they should actually be seeking to overcome them? Or do you think this is a limit of what is possible in terms of changing power relationships in the IMF? Just a few thoughts, thank you.
Thank you very much. Caroline is responsible for external relations and the whole relationship with, you know, with external actors, civil society, and of course also other states in the IMF. And you know, I think what would be very useful, Caroline, if you could tell us a little bit, apart from reacting to what you've heard, what the state of play actually is. I mean, where are we at in terms of the processing of the Emmanuel report?
Well, I think that's quite an easy question to answer, although you may not like the answer, so I'll perhaps go to that first. It's been received. The managing director has thanked Trevor and his colleagues for producing it, and I hate to have my back to everybody here, and so maybe I can move over here if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And we have not taken it up in any formal way. I think we're expecting maybe Trevor, maybe one of his colleagues will present it to our board, and then it may be discussed. But at the moment, we of course published it straight away so that everybody who's here and elsewhere who's interested in these issues can read it and have the kinds of discussions that we're having today. And I think we find that very useful. Of course, everybody, including myself, who is in the IMF one way or another, is a party to the issue of governance. And so I don't want to comment too directly on that. And as Trevor said, there are strong views in our board, and I'm still an employee of the institution and have responsibilities to the board, so I'm not going to go beyond that. But perhaps...
Take off the hat.
I would like to make a couple of comments about the issue of legitimacy and openness. I think that the IMF, well, we all know the IMF has been criticized a lot about being too secretive and closed. And I think that a lot of that criticism was legitimate. And I think that the IMF has tried to change and open up. Yes, the pace may be glacial by the measures of what's desirable. But actually the pace in the last few months has been certainly a trickle, if not a flood, and not a glacier. We've really changed a lot of the ways that we do business. We've created, of course, this new flexible credit line. We have changed the way that we describe and do conditionality. It doesn't mean that we get rid of conditionality, because that's got a sort of economic purpose, but it means that we're much more economical and streamlined and focused also on social aims in that. And we also, of course, trying to think how to channel and use these additional resources which we hope to get, and which the G20 is sort of charging us with, and the board may be charging us with, in an effective way to deal with the problems of the global economy. And we're also trying to be more candid and open about, and criticizing, as some of you know, the policies of the advanced economies. And I used to work in the US Treasury, so I know also that the advanced economies can be unwilling to hear good advice. I think one aspect of the openness is that, yes, we realize we need to listen to trade unions. I mean, Guy and I now know each other quite well, because we keep meeting at meetings where Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the managing director, is meeting with trade unions. And I think that's something that's begun, and it needs to happen more. On the issues of the report, maybe I'll just make a couple of points. Nancy mentioned coalition building, and I think that's essential. You know, this is an institution that represents 185 countries, not equally, but they're all there, and that means that there are really different coalitions, and there are, I would say, sort of four blocks that can that have some kind of blocking majority: the US, Europe, emerging markets as a whole, and low-income countries, although they don't. That brings me to my next point. Quotas are really important, but they're not the whole thing. Because, as Eshwar said, changes in quotas come a decimal point at a time. And Brazil now, if these reforms go through, will have 1.8% share in the institution instead of 1.4. Well, that's good, but it's not going to make a big difference when you think of needing 50% or 70% or 85%. But what does make a difference is how those countries are represented in the board, how much attention is paid by countries to the IMF and to the international system more broadly. And I think that which countries come forward and say, yes, we want to be part of this additional resources, that's a measure of how much we feel ourselves to be international citizens. Yes, we want to be involved in the debate about what the IMF does and how it does it. Yes, we want to have very good representatives. We want our ministers to show up and discuss and have ideas. All of those aspects of governance are also important. And certainly from my position, I feel that the IMF has a huge way to go to overcome what a colleague of mine described as the enduring stereotype of the IMF as a sort of closed, secretive, cookie-cutter type of organization. I don't think that's ever been quite true, but there are aspects of it that are true. But in order to overcome it, we also need to be hearing and to be engaged with by the rest of the world. And I think there's also a challenge out to those who have the smaller shares and less of a voice to think how to be a part of this international enterprise. And it's not just about what can we do for ourselves in each case. It's about saying, yes, the rest of the world matters to my economy, whether I'm in Africa or Asia or wherever. Just last point, Nancy pointed to, can't the US and Europe do a deal about something? And I was just sitting there thinking, aren't we past the days of the US and Europe doing just a deal? You know, it should be a multilateral agreement about how we go forward, because everybody is in this together. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. Let me just one little story, and then I'll turn to the floor. But because Guy is here, particularly, and because we're talking about transparency, it's a personal story from what you know I lived when I was in the government in Turkey. We were negotiating an IMF agreement, and part of it had to deal with public sector wages. Okay, and because things were done in a certain way, I mean, I'm not saying the IMF, you know, was saying this is the way we should do it, but they prepared what's called a side letter. And side letters, for those of you who have encountered them, were letters that were not published. They were really secret documents. And the idea was that, you know, I would sign a secret document about wages with the IMF mission. And even when we think about that, I mean, there's free bargaining between a government, a public authority, and a union. And then somewhere in some drawer, there is a secret document that would limit what we can give as a wage increase. Totally wrong. And of course, you know, we didn't do it. We refused it. It became very hard because the IMF wouldn't, you know, they did want an agreement on wages. And, you know, I mean, how can we sign a public agreement before we had the collective negotiation? Anyway, I don't want to go into details. We solved that problem. We had part of the letter of intent published dealing with public sector wages. But I just want to say that this, you know, idea that the IMF was secretive and was, you know, and in some sense undemocratic, or not undemocratic itself, but promoted undemocratic practices is not far-fetched and was part of reality. I think a lot has changed now. A lot of these practices have changed, but that is part of the burden that the institution still carries. Yes? Can you just very briefly identify yourself, I think? Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm Jo Marie Griesgraber with New Rules for Global Finance. And Trevor, we welcome the report, and you guys did a great job. I just want to say two things. One, I think that the work and functioning of the Board of Governors has been ignored. Those are all the ministers in the world, and they have relatively few committees. They're totally dysfunctional. They do pro forma speeches and go around and meet people, I guess. But it's not a governing board. I don't know what they do, but it's dysfunctional. And if you think the executive board is bad, look at the Board of Governors. So I think that's an area that truly needs to be reformed. The second thing is, even as, Trevor, you've been invited to take a second shot at this work, civil society, which is everyone except those of you getting a government paycheck, will be starting its own report. We've been invited by the fund to pool together input from civil society globally, and you had 10 months, we have six. So everybody in the room is welcome to give their input. There will be notice on the IMF board, and New Rules will be serving as your servant in collating this input. So just, there will be another shot at it, and almost everybody here qualifies to participate.
Thank you. Hear me.
My name is Abdul Ahmed. I'm from a computational science, small research firm. My question is this. Of course, the council's work is and recommendations is really very commendable, but in line with what Professor Prasad and Mr. Soros have said, it's obvious that it's a new world that has already changed. Things like funding private entities rather than public, which is what IMF does, or capital surveillance, seem to call for diversification of institutions rather than depending on one single IFC institution that was designed a half century ago. So my question is, what are the chances for redesigning the global financial system or the global like agencies like IFC to a diversified, I guess what I'm saying is institutional diversification of this whole governing structure to an alternative governing structure that does not exclude the IMF, but includes it as a partner.
All right, yes, in the back there. Yes, you have a mic. Great.
Dev Kar, lead economist at Global Financial Integrity and former senior economist in the IMF. The point that the reform amounts to decimal reform is well taken. But I think that even if the quota distribution would have been more equitable, we would still have the current global financial crisis. The reason being that conditionality is binding upon the countries that come to the fund for a loan. The use of fund resources. But conditionality is not binding on the surveillance countries where, you know, the fund gives advice in the surveillance mechanism. How would you address this? I mean, it's very difficult to give conditional advice to countries that are basically creditors, creditor countries. Conditionality is going to be more binding on countries that borrow from them. So I don't see this very easily to be resolved, this question.
Jean?
Thank you, Jean Pisani Bruegel. Just one point on surveillance. I think the report wishes to distinguish between the role of the council, the role of the management, the role of the board, and rightly said that surveillance should be assigned to management because on facts and analysis, you don't want to have a vote. You want to have a candid analysis, and that's the role of staff. Now, does it conflict or not with the will, sometimes expressed also, to give a stronger role to surveillance? If you want to tell some countries that they have to change their policy, it's good to have good analysis, but it may be needed also to have some backing and therefore to have behind you the voice of other countries in the organization.
Yes, there was a gentleman there in the middle. Yeah.
Thank you. John Sullivan. I'm a global emerging market strategist, Kerry, and formerly the portfolio manager for Darby Overseas here in Washington. My question is this, is more on the design of the IMF going forward, and I think Mr. Soros almost got to the touchline on this. This coming year, $1.5 trillion worth of emerging market debt is coming due. Two-thirds of that is corporate. Now, when I started banking many, many years ago, most of the lending to Latin America and Central Europe had to do sovereign to sovereign or bank to sovereign. Now it has changed. And I'm looking to the IMF to see what is your participation within the corporate market, which will have a knock-on effect with the current accounts of several countries. We've seen that with Iceland, we've seen it with Nigeria, and we're about to see it with Ireland.
We had, yes, one and then the gentleman here. Yeah, all the way back. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jack Borman. I was former policy director at the IMF. I'd like to make a lot of comments, but I won't. I'll limit myself to just one, if I may. I have for a long time been an advocate of the formation of the council, and it's just terrific to see it come back on the table again. I'm an advocate for many of the reasons that Trevor mentioned and that are conveyed in the report. But I have a question. It comes at an interesting time. It comes at a time when the G20 is ascendant. And there are many, many countries within the G20 who are very happy to be there around the table with the seven for the first time. And the G20 finance ministers have only recently put out a whole series of proposals that affect directly the IMF, whether it's financing or conditionality guidelines and the rest of it. And to a certain extent, I have a feeling that the IMFC, which is supposed to be the governing body of the IMF, has been essentially faced with a fait accompli on many of the important issues facing the institution. But let me ask, if the idea of the council goes ahead, how would you see the council and the emerging power of the G20 finance ministers being balanced with each other?
Very good question, Jack. Thank you very much. Yes, the gentleman here. And then I think we'll turn to the panel again.
Yeah, Chiao Chen, freelance correspondent. I would like to get to some very basic and fundamental thing. Dr. Prezer mentioned about function of the surveillance of IMF. And what's IMF or 2005, 2006, or 2007 country outlook? How come they didn't see such a big problem? So there must be very fundamental problem with an IMF. Then we talk about governance. He just mentioned that the Secretary of U.S. Treasury said yesterday that the IMF get strong. You can ask him the question, would U.S. listen to IMF? We look at that last time Asian crisis. Only those poor Asian countries listen to IMF. And IMF really do more harm than good. And so the question is this. Now we give the IMF a very big responsibility. And if no country going to listen to him and what to do. And then I just look this report. Yeah, you just look at what they say, conclusion. First one, defining moment. Okay, the important is the multi-level coordination. Each country is in disarray. They even cannot do their own country. How do they do the coordination? The important is that each member country got to have a political will to straighten out their banking system and financial system and do a real reform. And also they got commit, each country got commit. They're going to listen to IMF. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think we'll go again, start with Trevor, although then at the very end I'll come to you and give you the kind of last word, okay, Trevor? But we'll go this way and you pick up whatever you like and then George and José Antonio. And
okay. Long list of issues. I think that if I had a different shot at this, I may start with a proposal that you developed, Kemal, sitting here at Brookings and working with CGD, for something along the lines of an economic and social council where you have weighted representation in a constituency-based system. I think it's an idea whose time has come, and we must put that back in to play. The issue that Jose had raised about voting, there's a very clear proposal in paragraph 25 that allows for split votes. You've got to begin to test these ideas differently so that in a constituency-based system, smaller countries must know that their voices are heard as well. The issues of China, I think, are well taken. I accept the point about the Financial Stability Board, as it now is called. I think that the origin of the Financial Stability Forum was wrong. There's been this more recent attempt. It's now been endorsed by the G20. It's going to find traction. I think we must make it work. But there is a risk that you have various centers of multilateral decision-making that are not fully representative, that could spin out of control. The issue of timing in relation to G20, it's the last one I want to deal with now. Given the spring meetings, we try to get the report done and try to get the G20 to kind of be aware of the report. There is a reference, you'll find it in paragraph 20 of the communique of London on the 2nd of April. Some idea about the council, the support is there, and also the idea that additional resources would be made available, but we couldn't have a conditionality, trying to impose certain very substantive reforms in the fund. But I think that the sequencing was there, and we did try and take account of just the timing of these events. Let me stop there. I'd like to pick up on some of the others later.
Good. George?
Well, I'll take up this issue of the rollover of credit, because that is still largely an outstanding, unresolved issue. A lot of progress was made with the G20 and the replenishment of the IMF, and the IMF is now in a position to have country programs. But how to transfer the monies coming from the IMF to the private sector has remained unresolved. There needs to be some credit enhancements. I mean, there's currency risk and credit risk. Currency risk could be taken care of partly by the IMF programs, partly by swap agreements. And in that respect, I have to point out, it was pointed out to me today, that even the currency risk problem is not resolved because I'm talking now of one of the focal points of the crisis, which is Eastern Europe. And the European Central Bank has not really provided adequate swap lines to Eastern Europe. They did give a 5 billion euro line to Hungary, but only against hard currency paper. That's not much use. It would have to be Hungarian paper that could be used in the swap line. So I was surprised that even that problem is not fully resolved. But when it comes to the credit, take a case like Cemex in Mexico that have a loan coming due, and Mexico does have the swap lines, so there's no problem on the currency side. But who is going to take the credit risk? And even if the central banks got together as they used to and found a way of pressuring the banks to roll over their lines, it would be sufficient, because a lot of the credit is held outside the banking system. Hedge funds. A friend of mine has a lot of emerging market debt, and he's put it in a side pocket, where if people want to take their money out of the hedge fund, they can't take their money out until so he's going to hold those debts to maturity, and he certainly is not in a position to roll them over. So actually, the banks would have to increase their credit lines to take over the non-banks that with the securitization of debts that are. So I point that out because that is still an unresolved problem.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe. José Antonio.
Well, let me refer to the other issue, which is the issue of quotas, which is the last sentence of the quotas and SDRs. To say that I think actually the March decision on credit lines was a huge advance. I think the most important advance in a decade and probably more. Okay, so an issue that has come clearly to the floor is the issue of the size of the IMF. Now there are three ways of financing the IMF. There is arrangements to borrow, as they are called, credit lines from countries, and now the possibility also to go to the markets, doing bond issues, etc. I think this is the only one that you can use in the short term, but it's the least desirable one, because it's not a multilateral mechanism. Period. I think the IMF should be financed multilaterally, not by individual countries. So the second, that's why quotas are a much better mechanism. But the problem with quotas is this peculiar mechanism that was subject to long discussions in the creation of the IMF, of managing multiple currencies, most of which cannot be used for lending. Okay? Estimates say that it's only about 30% of quota that can be used for lending. So it's a bit of a very funny mechanism of financing, and then you have to provide that demand for dollar. I mean, the IMF has to look at demand for dollar, demand for euro, demand for other currencies. So it's a very complex mechanism, and that's why I think since the quota issue is going to be discussed, for the first time in three decades, there's going to be a serious discussion of special drawing rights. I think the discussion should be on turning the IMF in a fully SDR-based system, which is a proposal that has been on the table for decades. Actually, from one of the best proposals was done by an IMF economist, Jack Pollock. How would that work? In the countercyclical focus, you can think of two major mechanisms. You allocate increasing SDRs during crisis, such as the proposal of the $250 billion. That's one mechanism. But the second mechanism is to fully use SDR for lending, which can be done in either of two ways, in my view. The first is the one Pollock recommended, which is just do it, like central banks do lending. Just extend the up to a limit that you can decide collectively. But just do. You create SDRs by lending. Like central, the Fed is creating, dollars by lending. That mechanism has a very specific advantage that is truly countercyclical. In other words, when loans are paid back, you eliminate the issues of SDRs automatically. So I think that's one mechanism. Again, recommended by a famous IMF economist, three decades ago. And the other mechanism is the one I have suggested. Just use those SDR that have not been utilized by countries as deposits in the IMF, you know, that you can use for lending, so that you actually eliminate this funny division between the, you know, SDR account and what is the name of the other account?
The general
account, which is a funny division that I think should be eliminated, as, you know, has been recommended again for the. So now, since we are in a serious discussion of both quotas and SDRs, I think this is the decision to go. I think we should go for a fully SDR-based IMF. And I think that's it has many, many advantages over the alternative.
If we have the time, I'd like to make a comment here.
Okay.
I don't know how much time do we have.
Well, we're running kind of out, but do you want to make a quick comment right now?
No, it's not that quick.
Okay. Okay, let's go to Eshwar first then.
Okay, I'll just go to the fundamental question about the IMF and whether it should be playing the central role. I think the G20 has rightfully vested the IMF as an institution that doesn't have to be reinvented from scratch. And frankly, the IMF is a much better place than it used to be. I mean, we see that it still stokes fairly significant
passions. Don't want to go back to you.
Since I left, it's become a much better institution. It wasn't that long ago, actually. It's become much more open and transparent, and I think the flexibility with which it's developed new lines of lending, I think, are definitely to be commended. And we do have a more open process where the managing director and senior officials are willing to come out and engage, so there is much progress there. But again, it's the context that the IMF operates in that concerns me, because there are issues about the IMF's effectiveness that are not in the hands of the staff or the management. It is about how the fund becomes more legitimate and relevant to the countries that really matter. And this is not like countries don't matter, but there are certain issues that ultimately a smaller group of countries has to be relevant for in terms of global macro and financial stability. And if you think about how the crisis right now is moving to the shores of the poorer countries and affecting them, although they are seen as essentially the innocents who are getting swept up in the midst of this crisis, it was a core group of countries, again, an expanded core that has affected this. And I think that's where the IMF's relevance should really be focused. And so issues like quota reform are mostly relevant for that particular group of countries. And yet the IMF, by being a multilateral institution where everybody has a voice, although proportionate voice, I think can be the institution that fosters stability on these dimensions.
Thank you. George, why don't you?
Yeah, okay. Developed a practical proposal for using SDRs for countercyclical purposes to support or stimulate the periphery countries. Because we have stimulus packages because we can afford to do that. The periphery countries are not in a position to stimulate their economies, and it's very much in our interest, the global interest, and of course their interest, to stimulate domestic demand. To do it, the trouble with SDRs, for this to achieve this, the rich countries that can print their own money ought to transfer their allocations to the countries that can't. However, this runs into an apparently insuperable problem that because the SDRs carry interest, this would count in the national debt of the countries. And with the tremendous increase in the deficit in this country, in Europe, et cetera, it just wouldn't pass Congress. So it's a non-starter. And some other way has to be found. And there, I think one could use the gold reserves of the IMF, of which there's plenty, to pay the interest, which is minimal, and so that there would be no interest payment. It would be, and actually, you wouldn't even need to distribute the SDRs to the countries. You could actually allocate them for fostering global public goods, education, health, and the environment, the global warming issues, preserving the rainforests, maybe for strengthening subsistence agriculture in Africa, all very worthwhile objectives. It would be then, you see, you'd also overcome another very serious problem, that if you just distribute free money to the less developed world, well, that money is liable to disappear because the governments are not that wonderful in those parts of the world. So you really need to have some control over how the money is used. So this would then be used, you would be put in the hands of organizations like the Global Fund for Infectious Diseases. You would have to set up a fund for rainforests, etc. While the IMF has a lot of gold, you can't. This would be outstanding forever, and it would not be sound. Therefore, if you are using it in a countercyclical way, and you're using the present situation when there are a lot of idle resources that could be put to use in this way, in a very, very constructive way, then when things return to normal, or maybe the economies are beginning to overheat a little bit, then you withdraw the SDRs. So they would not be outstanding forever, but just for maybe 10 years or 5 years or however long. And I think this would be a major contribution to stimulating demand in exactly where it is needed. So it's not only global demand, but also call it redistribution, which is a very important objective also.
All right. Before turning to Trevor for the final word, I think we do get from this discussion, I think, the feeling that the SDR issue is going to be quite central in the coming months and years. And as the fund grows, you know, Jose Antonio's view of an SDR-funded fund, the use of these SDRs, I think it's going to be a major issue ahead of us. Let me just say one thing on Jack Bormann's point about the G20. I think it may be useful looking forward to looking at the G20 as an L20, a leaders level, heads of state, prime ministers, presidents, but not finance ministers. And then I think it becomes easier to reconcile, you know, an overall apex L20 that deals not only with finance, but with global warming, with peace issues, with proliferation, nuclear issues, and so on. And then the council, if it comes to be in some form, would really be the finance forum and closely linked to the IMF. To me, that would make the most sense. Trevor, you have the last word.
Thank you very much.
At least here.
let me just express appreciation for all of the comments and questions. I want to turn to what Guy Ryder raised and just try and tie it up with the question raised. I didn't get the surname, I'm sorry. Chow? What would have happened if these proposals had been developed a decade ago? It's a very open question, but I think there are two important issues. The first is that the quality of advice given must be received. If countries resist the advice, then you don't have a basis for multilateralism. And I think that is at the heart of all of this, regardless of the proposals, because you don't have the force of arms. You must therefore have a basis for intellectual respect and agreement, because that is at the very center of it. Now, along the line, certainly in the past 7 years or so, we saw the build-up of these huge global imbalances. And it started with the big debate around the twin deficits in the United States. And the advice was parried and not taken. And I think that part of the difficulty we're living through is that, and that I think should serve as a conscience for the kinds of decisions that must be taken going forward. I think that
So the role of surveillance and the ability of the fund to be above reproach in the way in which it sets about its surveillance is also important. There were some issues relating to what was called multilateral surveillance in the past while that had clearly diminished the fund as well. Part of the big challenge to all of us as policymakers everywhere is to try and get a higher level of legitimacy, because even now there still is a measure of stigma, which I think the flexible credit line begins to work past. But the stigma is a big, big obstacle to the development of multilateralism, and that I think is something that we need to be a part of. I want to emphasize the point that if this was generally agreed to within the panel, if the IMF didn't exist and you needed to restructure something, you needed to put something in the center, it would begin to take on many of the manifestations of the IMF without the baggage. And part of what we need to try and do is to reconstruct the IMF at the center, strip away all of the issues that don't belong there, and allow it to deal with the issues that it has to deal with. Jack, your question about the Council and the G20, I think, is a very important question. Part of what we must try and get to is the minimization of the number of meetings. And as we deal with that, I think the board will or the governors' meetings would have a lot more substance. At the moment, governors meet only to advise the board, and if the board won't take the advice of governors and they won't even take the advice of the leaders in London on the idea of the council, you have a fundamental difficulty. That's a difficulty that we have to bridge, and Caroline, your point about the board is very important in this regard. We have to be able to work past those issues. You can't have progress blocked by individuals who might have carved out a particular role in history for themselves. I think the issue of quotas and the SDR are very, very important issues, and I agree. This fractional approach is not going to work. There's a very different world. You have to understand what the differences are in the world, take the decisions in the interest of multilateralism. And in this regard, I think that Tim Geithner's piece in the FT this morning, I think it was this morning, Eshwar, yes. Not, was it yesterday?
I saw it yesterday.
Okay. Yesterday.
It was online yesterday, okay. Thank you. But that I think, speaks to what we need to do. They're big decisions that go beyond the sovereign borders, and I think that this is the moment, and this is what we must try and utilize now. This, I think there are so many ideas out there. I look around this room, I look at the panel, I know a number of ideas that I've encountered. There's a lot that we have to distill and try and put it together, but it requires one issue, and that is political will. And that is the big, big drive. If we can get the political will in place now, I think that we can do this. I think it's only the beginning. I don't think that I have the patience for a second round, Nancy. But I think it is a very, very important beginning, because it's about recognizing the mutual accountability framework that exists within a multilateral system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, on behalf of all of us, let me thank again the four panelists. Thank you very much for coming, taking the time, and thank you for all of you. And now enjoy the beautiful weather outside.